The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
Kia ora koutou. Welcome to a summary issue of Dietary Requirements, the Spinoff's food podcast. We've taken a break for Christmas to eat and drink with our families rather than our listeners. But that means you get to re-listen to some of our favourite episodes of the year. This one was a real privilege. We got to speak to Monique Fiso about her incredible new book, Hiakai, named after her restaurant. And I foraged in the nearby bushes of the Morningside shrubbery and made some tea from Kawakawa, and we learned all about the renaissance of Kai Māori. Kia ora. Nau mai, haere mai ki Dietary Requirements, the Spinoff's food podcast. Each month, we get together to talk about the cultural, social, and political role of food in Aotearoa with some of the buzziest people in the local scene. I'm your host, Simon Day, and as always, I'm joined by the Spinoff's food editor, Alice Neville.
Kia ora.
And Hospo boss, Sophie Gilmore.
Kia ora, Simon.
The podcast and all our food coverage at the Spinoff would not be possible without the support of our wonderful sponsor, Freedom Farms. They believe that everyone who eats meat has a responsibility to know how those animals have been raised. Their pork, bacon, and free-range eggs are delicious, and we wouldn't be here without them, so please eat their products. Today we're very lucky to be joined by Chef Monique Fiso. Her CV makes me feel very inadequate. She's just 32 and is one of the most important chefs New Zealand's ever produced. After cooking in some of New York's best restaurants, she returned home and has been at the forefront of the revitalization and celebration of Kai Māori, looking at the techniques and ingredients of our indigenous culture. She's starred on Netflix and National Geographic shows. Her restaurant, Hiakai, was listed on Time Magazine's 100 Greatest Places in the World, and she's just released a stunning book, also called Hiakai, and it traces her personal journey, the history of Kai Māori, and guides readers on how to incorporate indigenous ingredients and techniques into their own cooking. Thank you for joining us, Monique. It's really cool to have you here.
And thank you for having me here.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
It's so much more than a cookbook. What were you trying to achieve with it?
Well, I think what I wanted to achieve was not just create a book that was a selection of recipes, but create a book that I was struggling to find, which was something that had the ingredients and also some tips on how to use the ingredients, as well as a bit of background history in general, because I think, just having a selection of recipes with no context into what we were using wasn't going to help anybody. And I also wanted to help people sort of create their own path or with the ingredients themselves. So rather than me going, this is what we've done and this is the only, we're just going to show you, you know, what we've figured out how to do with it. I wanted to be like, this is what we've done and this is what we've figured out, but also this is what you could do and here's some information and you can go and take that and do what you like with it. And hopefully we'll see some of that on menus in the future.
Because that whole idea has been a big part of what you've done since you've returned to New Zealand, because the way we've thought about Kai Māori and its value has been a little bit undercooked until now in many ways.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to, one, traditionally Māori history has been an oral history, and, you know, since colonisation. I don't want to get too deep into that. There has
it's
been
important.
A bit of
I don't
a
think
disconnect.
We should be afraid
you know,
of
there's
about
been
it.
A lot of lost information and things that would normally be passed down haven't been passed down. And yeah, I think not having something to get out of the library or go and purchase and just sit down and read to understand things has kind of made it a bit harder to delve into the subject. So I think one of the biggest things I wanted to do with this book was kind of not answer every question when it comes to Kai Māori, because there's still so much more to learn, but at least give people a starting point, or at least pass on what I've learned so far to date to help people begin their journey.
Sounds like the recipes are the easy part of the book.
The recipes,
you must have done so much research.
The recipes were the easy part, yeah. You know, and it was funny because the publishers were like, so the recipes, you know, like, are you struggling with it? You need any help with that? I was like, that is the last thing I need help with.
Yeah.
I just need time to make sure that, like, everything else is correct, you know, and the rest will follow. And that is 100% how it played out. And it was kind of funny looking back because I was given 6 months to write the book and I took 2 years. And the list, if you look through, there's so many, if you look in my Google Drive, there's so many drafts of like how the chapters are going to play out. And the original list of what the recipes were and what they eventually ended up being in the book were totally different.
Right.
And that was because over that time, we're learning more and more about different ingredients and how to use them, that it was kind of like, looking back now, if I was to do it again, I wouldn't have even bothered trying to write what the recipes were going to be.
Yeah.
Back in 2018, I would have just left that until I'd finished writing the first two and then just kind of gone, all right, now we do that part. But, you know, it was my first time writing a book and I don't think it's a, I mean, you guys at the Spinoff write every day and, you know, it's a messy but beautiful process, and I don't know. It's made me feel like, oh, cooking's not that hard.
who has been your kaiako? Who has guided you in helping you learn these histories and these techniques and about the ingredients?
Definitely. Well, there's two people I would point to immediately, and one would be Joe McLeod, who he is based in Wellington, and he was a chef for years and years and years. He's still occasionally does the odd hangi and workshop, but he has just a wealth of knowledge. And I was put in touch with him by Casey and Karina, the two MasterChef winners.
Mm.
And it just happened, we were having a glass of wine, and I said, do you guys know anybody who has a bit more knowledge about this? And they go, there's a guy, here's his email address. They scribbled it down. I emailed him. He emailed back in full Tadeo, and I'm not fluent at all. So then I called my cousin and said, can you help me out? I need to translate this email so I can respond to him and try to set up a meeting. And it was kind of funny. I was like, maybe he's trying to see how serious I am, you know? Like,
what did he say was the reason that he just wrote back in today?
He's just Joe. I've since learned that he's just an interesting character. But so basically what happened was I met up with him, and he took me basically on a series of bushwalks for an entire summer, and then we would just go through some of the stuff he's learnt. He has this little study at his house full of all these books, like the whole collection from Elsdon Best, and just all these notes and just folders of things he's collected over time. And I pretty much spent months of my summer just sitting there reading them and still borrowing books from him to this day. So he was definitely one person who helped me really like deepen my knowledge. And another person was Tracy Berner, who is the co-author of the book. So she's a professor at Auckland University, and she spent a lot of time. She also co-authored some books with Robert Oliver. So her focus has been on Polynesian ingredients and Polynesian food history, as well as New Zealand food history. So she was somebody who had a lot of knowledge, not necessarily as a chef, but like a lot of history, I guess, with customs and techniques and interesting I learned so much about how to research from her as well, you know, like beyond Google and going to, you know, your obvious places, but like little tips and tricks that you would know if that is literally your profession. Yeah. So it's been
so
a really
interesting,
awesome journey.
Like such an academic process, hey?
Yeah.
Because food is so much more than just cooking and eating. It tells you about who you are and where you come from. And
yeah.
And has that been something you've sort of actively approached with Hiakai, both the book and the restaurant? And your pop-ups as well?
Yeah, I think it's always been an interest for me in general. I've always been a real history geek. From as young as I can remember, constantly getting out books, like history books as a kid, and being way more interested in the History Channel than reality TV. And that's just, it's kind of, so I feel like quite lucky that I've been able to integrate a lot of things that like fascinate me into a living. I've always kind of found, like, food is delicious, but I've always been interested as to why things are the way they are or how things end up being created. And usually they're created because of climate or something going on socially or, like, you know, there's a lot of, and I just find it really fascinating, and I think that's what kind of keeps me ticking. And so, you know, being in a position where I get to do this, but with my own culture, is really, really cool, to find out the reasons why and then also kind of add another layer onto that for future generations.
Did you feel like it was kind of time for someone to put a modern lens or modern cooking techniques with those ingredients? I mean, I know Katarina and Casey were doing a bit of it, but it sort of feels like such a great moment that was needed.
Oh, for sure. I think when you've learnt, you've built like a skill set as a chef, to me it made sense to use that to put it towards my own culture rather than something else. I don't know, that's just kind of how I felt. Was it just felt like the natural path for me to take what I'd learned and in kitchens and different techniques from different cuisines and apply it to my own heritage.
Are you just cooking with native ingredients every day, like at home?
At home? Oh, that'd be... Katie and I work...
you're like, when's crazy home? Hours. I don't eat at home.
It would, yeah, that's something, that's a work in progress. The industry requires us to work a lot of hours sometimes.
And
I would like to do more at home. I would like to do more at home, but at the restaurant, it's every day, every day. And I think sometimes, you know, like... you know, I will look at, you know, you get so lost in the day to day that sometimes, you know, you got to take a pause and go, we're actually playing around with ingredients that like no one else is playing, like is using.
Yeah.
We should just like kind of take a moment to think about how awesome that is just for a second.
Have you found, like, who is your ideal person to be reading the book? Have you found like young chefs are getting more into looking at this idea of using indigenous ingredients through what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Who is my ideal person to be reading the book? I think the book, I definitely had young chefs in mind, as people who'd be interested in the information, and definitely people who had been constantly sliding into the DMs with questions. Yeah. So I was like, hopefully this answers a lot of those questions that keep coming through.
Like, can I go for coffee and pick your brain for
a minute? Yeah, I get that a lot. I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. My mum can't get coffee with me at the moment. I don't know about you. I definitely had that person in mind. I also had, you know, people who were just interested in... I wanted to create a little bit of a history book as well for people who just had a general interest in food history. So those were sort of my two ideals of people who might be interested in the book.
So will success to you look like more restaurants in New Zealand serving indigenous ingredients or more home cooks foraging and getting their hands on it?
I think success to me will look like definitely seeing a little bit more in restaurants, but also home cooks or people just understanding.
Yeah.
Like pointing to some of the ingredients or some of the plants in there and going and knowing what that plant
totally.
Is. Totally.
It's just familiarity, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's what success to me will look like, is just, you know, the average person going, oh, that's red matipo. You can infuse it into a syrup and make a sorbet with it.
Yeah.
You know, and that just being common knowledge.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Do you ever think about the implications of, like, non-Māori chefs getting really into, like, do you worry about cultural appropriation, or what do you think?
I think everybody has a right to experiment with the ingredients, and I encourage everyone to learn more about this and experiment with the ingredients. And so long as they're doing it in a respectful way, which in the book it goes through, like, what those customs are and, like, how to do it respectfully, then great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Real little things that I loved in the book, like the idea of when you forage, taking a third, leaving a third for the next generation and leaving a third for regeneration is such a cool way to think about our place in the food system as a whole.
Exactly. I mean, with the foraging that we'll do for the restaurant, we have our spots, and I'm not going to say them on the podcast, otherwise we're going to have a rude restaurant
in
Wellington.
Like, is it like that? Is also, it like surfing where it's like secret spots that
we have a few secret spots. Some of the other like chefs, other restaurants sometimes, like, can we come with you guys? And then we do, and then we're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have, because now we're going to see them out there like every Monday or Tuesday. But we kind of will focus on a spot for a bit, and then we kind of will move on and leave. Like, because we just know that, like, if you go in somewhere and you take everything, then there's going to be nothing when you come in. And then that's the complete opposite of, you know, Te Ao Māori and Māoriwood.
Māori custom? Because I went to cooking school in Ireland, and that was a technique that we were taught as well. And I guess they kind of claimed it as like an Irish foraging technique. So maybe it's just the international.
Yeah, I think it's just
respect for what you're doing.
For Earth.
Yeah. And the regeneration, it's key.
Yeah.
How important has foraging become to everything that you do? Because it's, you know, it's something that has very much been associated with the Manique Fiso Hiakai brand.
Yeah.
But is it the only way for you to source some of these ingredients?
It's actually getting a lot easier. Like quite a few ingredients that we weren't able to source in the early years, we're now able to get through some suppliers, which is pretty awesome.
There was a buzzy guy on Country Calendar.
Peter Langland?
Yes, in Wellington, and he walks around with bags, like, picking up beautiful flowers, and I was thinking at the time, I was like, I bet, like, Hiakai.
He's not Wellington, is he?
He's Canterbury.
Yeah. Oh, was he?
And occasionally he does come up, though. He comes in, one of our suppliers, Scott McNeil from Awatoru, he'll go and forage with him.
Yeah.
And we will often get a message saying, oh, Peter and I are going out to this area. We might find this, and this. If we do, are you interested in any? And they won't. Yeah, it's kind of a bit quirky, like the way they do it. And it's kind of a
hypothetically,
bit,
if we find some, yeah,
hypothetically, if we find this thing, do you want some? Yeah. And then we'll be like, yeah, okay. And then it'll just show up, or maybe it won't. But like, don't hold your breath. He is a very, very quirky dude.
Almost like meditative when he was doing it. Hey, he was like walking around, just like quite a buzzy dude that had a real appreciation for, you know, the what was happening with the ingredients, but more was specifically interested in his role in it. He's like, you know, off they go and do fancy things in restaurants, but he just walks around and knows every single plant in New Zealand. It was really impressive.
Amersfield hired him as their
full-time forager. Wow. Imagine being a full-time... What are you? I'm a full-time forager.
Is that like a census form?
And his partner, Melanie, I think her name's Melanie, apologies if it's not, her name's not Melanie. Mm-hmm. I think she's quite into foraging too. I think she also does quite a bit on her own for her own learning. I've seen a little bit.
Do they take people out on
little foraging. They do the
occasional workshop.
I wonder if they like met in the bush, like over over a kawakawa plant.
Yeah, tripped over a kawakawa plant.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. So as with the recipes, are the ingredients mostly available, or should I be sort of keeping an eye out when I'm jogging in the Waitakere bush for things? Like, yeah. How accessible are the things that we're using in the book?
That's a good question. And that was an interesting topic as I was deciding like what to include in the book and what not to. Because I was like, oh, okay, some of these things that, you know, some people might never be able to get, but I thought, okay, well, I'll just include some of them because it's just important to know about them, or it will be of interest to somebody out there. I would say that probably 60% of them are pretty easily accessible. If you were going for a walk in the Waitakere Ranges, you would find kawakawa, horopito, pickle pickle. Maybe the kiakia stems might not be blooming or just yet, but you might see those. Tikuka, nikau palm, you know, you'll find a lot of those, but maybe some of the other ingredients you might not, you know, it would just be scarce.
What about things like titi and wicker? Like, how easily can I get my hands on that sort of protein?
Befriend somebody from Ngātahu for the titi.
Titi in season, I think some. I know, like my food writer friends have tried. You can kind of order it.
Yeah.
At a certain time.
You definitely can.
I remember when I interviewed you a couple of years ago, Weka. You just had it. It was only legal on to hunt it on the Chathams, right?
It's only legally hunted on the Chathams, and somebody like. You need to know someone who's on the Chathams who has a permit, and then they are allowed to send it to you. You're not allowed to purchase it. So they gift it to you as a koha, and you can't then legally... Like, I wouldn't be allowed to then put it on the menu. Sure. I would be in deep right. trouble.
Yeah, so you're experimenting, and there was a lot of stuff on your Instagram, like
Kentucky Fried Wicker. Oh, yeah, it's a funky bird. It's got... I don't know. I thought that it would be really similar to duck. It's not.
Right.
Not by a long shot. And it had this layer of fat that was quite yellowy. And really thick, and it just like leached. Yeah, it just kept rendering the fat off and spitting everywhere. And the meat, the skin crisped up pretty good, but the meat, it wasn't as tender as I thought it would be. It did tender if I braised it, but the smell as well was just, it was super gamey and funky, and I was had like the extractors on, and I was like, whoa, like this is intense, you know. This isn't
It's a tough ask.
It's not a duck.
But did you find a way to cook it that was good? Because I think that's something that is really important to everything you do. It's not just about using crazy, cool, interesting ingredients. It has to taste good.
It does. At the end of the day, it needs to taste good. Otherwise, what's the point, you know? I think there's... Sometimes you can have things that are polarizing or interesting, but you kind of got to still have something that... is palatable.
That's it too. Like, people like being challenged, don't they? But only so far.
So if I found my hands on some wicker,
what
should I do?
What should you do? Knowing what I know now, I would probably just trim the skin off to start with, and then cure it for maybe 8 hours with a little bit of salt and some herbs and a little bit of sugar. Then I'd wash the cure off and then probably try braising it. And hopefully, like, the curing and the brining will break down some of that meat a little bit before starting to braise it. But, yeah, I've definitely learned that braising it was the best way, and that no matter how low and slow I tried to roast it or confit it, it was never going to break down as well as if I just braised it.
What's been your... with pumpkin and boil-up broth recipe in here. It looks pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Travel to the Chathams for that one.
Yeah, what's your most delicious discovery where you're like, oh my God, that is the most delicious thing discovery I've ever had?
Oof, I can think of... Let's pick one. The one that was definitely very peculiar and made me question what we had in the jars was when we worked with Kiwi Blossoms the first time, and Joe was the one who called us up and said, oh my gosh, you've got to come out to this area in Wellington. Not going to say where it is. The whole hillside's got Kiwi Blossoms. They're just going crazy. I haven't seen it like this in years. So we went on this big mission as a team, and we got as many as we could, and we were like, what do we even do with this? And he's like, well, I just put mine in gin, but you can put it in syrup if you want. So we spent the afternoon cleaning them up and putting them in gin and putting them in simple syrup. And then he's like, what do we do now? And he's like, well, you just leave it for 6 months and it'll change and turn into this really interesting concoction. And we're like, oh, okay. Probably about a month in, we noticed that the jars were like bubbling and going nuts, and we're like, this isn't like, as a chef, you're like, this means something has gone horribly wrong.
They're in airtight jars.
Yeah, we'd like gone through the home, we're like, this, something's gone really wrong here. And they'd all changed colours, and they had gone like almost like hibiscus red, and we're like, okay, this is really weird. So
cool.
We called up Joe, and he's also not the most savvy with a smartphone. I don't think he even has a smartphone, so it's not like you could take a picture and be like, Joe, check this out. We're like, these jars are like bubbling, and they're like, look like they're gonna is this what is supposed to happen? He's like, yeah, it's fine. We're like, are you sure? Like, we're kind of too scared to eat it, and like, it's making a mess everywhere. So then he rocks up, as he does, and he like looks at it, and he's like, no, that's normal, try tasting it now. And it was just like this explosion of almost like hibiscus and vanilla and pear.
Wow.
Like, and it was just like the colour was so rich. So then by the time, so we did this before we opened the restaurant. By the time we opened the restaurant, all the jars were ready to go. And so the Wicked. First pre-dessert we had on the menu had the Kia Kia syrup with the Kia Kia gin that we'd been infusing. It's actually, the recipe's in the book.
Awesome.
It was, yeah, I think that would be like one of those moments where you're like, I have no idea what this is or what I'm working with. And I,
and so Joe knows, yeah. But does anyone else know and use it?
Well, they can now.
Yeah.
So Joe told us and we told everyone in a book.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
And that's a good reminder. We actually, I forgot to mention this earlier, we have a book to give away to our listeners. To enter the competition, please send us a photo or video of food that you've been cooking and send that to AliceNeville@thespinoff.co.nz or at Dietary Requirements Podcast on Instagram. And be warned, we if it looks delicious enough, we'll post it to our social media. And if it looks really good, we'll send you a book.
Woohoo! Ooh.
Ki te kahore he whakakitinga ka ngaro te iwi. Without foresight or vision, the people will be lost. Kia ora koutou, I'm Stacey Morrison. Join me for Conversations That Count, Ngā Kōrero Whai Take, a new series brought to you by Massey University and The Spinoff. I'll be chatting to academics, activists and industry leaders to turn a unique lens on the issues impacting Aotearoa and Te Ao Whānui. From structural equality to liberalising drug policy, implications for our mokopuna and more, will bring you thought-provoking kōrero about the things that count for all of us. New episodes will be available each month, so subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts.
But I actually got your book from my husband for my birthday recently.
Awesome.
I don't have it, but I'm definitely going to get it now.
Yeah, so it's actually so like cool. A put next to the bed and spend 6 months reading bit by bit. Mm. It's awesome.
So when I wrote about going to Hiakai, I wrote about the way the menu told me a story. It felt like going on this really nostalgic childhood journey through New Zealand, which I thought was really beautiful. And then to learn that your new menu is inspired by Patricia Grace's children's book, Watercress Tuna and the Children of Champion Street, tuna being the Māori word for eel. I thought that was a really wonderful idea to take something that, you know, an important story to you and retell it through your food. How do you translate a book into food?
That's a good question. That's I guess that the creative process of that is just as painful as writing a book. We basically, what we'll start off doing is look at the book and like kind of discuss themes. It usually starts with myself, Katie, who's our general manager, and Olivia, who's the restaurant manager, will sit down and kind of go read the source material and kind of go, well, there's a few natural places to start. So this in the book, there's the magical tuna, and tuna visits all the children, and they all have like different backgrounds, and they get different gifts given to them, and then they dance on the street at the end. So we're like, okay. So some of the themes here are things like kotahitanga, which mean like, you know, community and unity. There's obviously a strong theme of kanikani because they dance at every single house. There's all this multiculturalism, which is so ahead of its time because the book came out in 1984. Then there's Patricia Grace herself, who is a New Zealand legend. And then we went and met with her and had, you know, some tea and ginger loaf at her house and, you know, just kind of discussed, like, her reasons for writing the book and what was on her mind in 1984 and, you know, and her life's work. And then
we just kind of do
that to start with, and then things slowly start to form, and like these, you know, this is a children's book, so childhood kind of feels like a natural place to start. The book was made in 1984, so let's do the next course, which pays tribute to 1984. Then the next course, let's pay tribute to the main character, so that the next course is all about watercress tuna. And so you've got two ingredients there that are obviously natural places to start. Then the book is also taking place in Champion Street, and I grew up in Ascot Park. Nan, my grandma, lives in Cannons Creek. I used to go up and down Champion Street constantly helping her doing groceries. And in the book as well, like there's Cannons Creek Primary School. My dad went there. The shops are there. Like everything as it was in the late 80s when I was a kid is there. So, you know, the next course is Champion Street. The next one after that is basically a tribute to Patricia Grace. So we did Wahine Tour. So we'll integrate Polynesian and Māori ingredients as a tribute to both her and I as women working in, you know, male-dominated industries, and then have a course representing that. Then the next one is kotahitanga, which is just like embracing the whole the book and like its themes of togetherness. And the last one is kanikani, to talk about. The book ends there with them dancing. Well, they actually go to sleep at the end. It's quite cute. They're all in sleeping bags. Aww. But like right before they all fall asleep, they're all dancing on the street, and they dance all day, they dance all night.
But dancing has to be a dessert course.
Yeah, so it's like
we cool.
Yeah, and then that's where it ends.
What is the dessert course?
The dessert course, so there's three dessert courses at the moment, and so there's the Wahine Tour course, the kotahitanga course, and then kanikani.
Yeah.
And then I guess it sounds like we just kind of like it happened. It sounds way more structured than the actual process is. I mean, I think a lot of the team know when we're getting like down to the pointy end of trying to figure out the courses and get it onto the menu, that there's, you know, I can be a little bit, don't talk to me.
Like, also, like,
I'm an artist, don't talk to me.
As you want, or you could be like, it's loose interpretation of that suits too, right?
And it's like, funny too, because once we get it on the menu, then we're like, and seasons change, and then we start doing little incremental changes.
Yeah.
So it's like the story you get at this, so it changes basically like four times a year, the story, and it will run for about 3 months. But the one you'll get at the start might be quite different to the one you'll get at the end of that 3 month period because so many ingredients have changed.
Yeah.
So like we've kind of been going through that at the moment because obviously a lot of the summer produce is starting to come through.
I found that was so interesting about dining at Heakai is that it was really nostalgic. When it feels like it's such a future foodie experience.
Yeah.
You know, like you're sitting there eating flavours that feel really nostalgic. And I loved your front of house team. I think the person that served us was like 16 years old and like probably a bit older, but just, you know, felt really young and really keen.
I
want to
know
awesome.
Who you thought was 16.
Honestly, how? What's the youngest waitress? I mean, this was like maybe a year or... A year ago?
Oh, gosh, I got to wonder who that would have been.
Maybe it was even... Well, how long's Heakai been open?
Almost 2 years.
Yeah, I think we came right at the start. But it just honestly felt like the coolest, freshest, young team that...
We're a team of millennials, and that's what's quite cool, because, you know, millennials get a lot of stick for being, like, you know, lazy and this and that, and, like, wishy-washy.
No one works harder than
But, like, our team is so hard-working.
Yeah, totally.
And I was, you know, stoked to see them at the awards last night, you know, People's Choice representing, you know. It was really cool.
And more inclined to be working in something that they're really passionate about. So if they get to work for you, then, you know, that's like the top of their game. So they're better than anyone would be that was from another generation that was just doing something they felt like they should do.
I think we have, this is just me, obviously I'm biased, I think we have the best front of house team in the country.
Woohoo!
But I'm obviously biased. It's like a mother with her children. I'm like, they're the best.
They're so advanced. They're so advanced.
They're the cutest.
I thought they were awesome.
Does it ever feel like a burden, Monique, in the way that you're talked about? You know, headlines are always New Zealand's most important chef. You know, there is what, you know, people often think of you as the only person who's holding Māori cuisine.
Yeah.
And, you know, you obviously stand on the shoulders of people like Joe. Does it stress you out?
Definitely. I think it's an honour to be in that position, but also, you know, there is a lot of responsibility. And I think, I think I just try to not get too stressed out about it, but at the same time understand that what my position is in the food world.
I think just like by being you and doing what you're doing, you're kind of paving the way. But being told that you're paving the way is probably quite stressful. You know, it's like, just let me do my thing, because, you know, that's the way that it's like authentic to you and that you're doing such a great job.
Yeah, I think I can get a little bit lost in my head sometimes of like, oh, you know, like, is this, you know, because there is a lot of pressure there, but then it's kind of like, well, just kind of stick to who you are and it should be okay. That sounds like almost a naive way of thinking, but
is it such a different pressure, because, you know, you've worked in high pressure kitchens in the more traditional sense, and then it's like, you know, now you're at the helm and you've got the responsibility, but does it feel different, the responsibility and the pressure?
Yeah, I think there's just, you know, different expectations of me than there was before. But it's also just, I'm very lucky to be in that position. So although there's a lot of pressure, it's kind of like, well, what an awesome life that we're living, and like what awesome work we get to do. So even though there's the pressure and, you know, it can be quite scary, it's also like, well, look at what we've done. So like try to focus on that rather than focus too much on...
And do you run your kitchen in a different way to the other kitchens that you've worked in? Like, does it feel unique?
I'd say so. I mean, for one, the kitchen's completely open during service, so, you know, there's not a lot of
hiding,
yelling,
anywhere,
screaming, pots. Yeah, it's a lot
naughty
more
behavior,
like non-verbal communication, and you know, it's a little bit more fun and just kind of forces you to work in a way that's, you mean, you're on show the entire time. So it's quite, what I quite like about it, and a lot of the cooks, well, the chefs will talk about it too, is that because you can see the guests, it kind of makes you think a little bit more about what you're doing. Because it can be like, when if you're working in a basement, there's a disconnect. You're like, this is ticket, you know, 11. You know, you don't know what they look like. Whereas when you're actually, when you're at Hiko, you're like, table 6 are these two people, and like, you know, we've got to make, they're going to look at me if I put this up funny.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, awesome. So we have a very different team. And our team as well, it's like there are sections, but there isn't really sections. So, you know, for service, everyone has a different section they're doing for service, so there'd be like there's pastry, sauté, grill, all on the counter. But during prep, we all have a hand in different things, which I think when people first start, they're like, oh, this is
crazy, you know, like this is quite confusing. But then they wrap their head around it, so like everyone takes on like different things. So like even though I'm working grill at the moment, I also do like a lot of the pastry work, and and so everyone gets to learn a lot of different things, and then we'll switch the stations like every like 1 or 2 months. So just as you're getting comfortable and you've like learned it, you then have to move, and it and then it just makes that everyone knows how to help each other, and have respect for each other's roles, because they realise like why you might need help when all these desserts are getting called away.
How are you and your team after this year? Because obviously it's been really horrific for hospitality.
Yeah.
You know, are you guys okay? And what did, have you learned about the industry from what COVID-19's given us?
Our team's awesome. Like we're doing okay, and I think the fact that the borders are closed and we're still fully booked months in advance just shows that there is a lot of local support for restaurants. And I think you know, New Zealand and like everything that happened with the lockdowns, like we've done really well as a country in comparison. So I just feel like so many of my friends have been affected so much more in the US and in Melbourne that like I almost feel like there's no way I can complain, you know. I don't think, you know, I feel really lucky to be in this country. Did we have a stressful time during lockdown? Absolutely, everyone did. And we had to change up a lot of things and the way we did things, and the months afterwards was a lot of like trying to rebook people, trying to make sure we were dealing with social distancing. But it was also kind of this weird kind of team bonding where it made us so much closer as a group, because we were all in, you know, stuck in it together and having to work it out as we went along. But I think what's been good is it's kind of made, I don't know how it is in Auckland, but in Wellington I've noticed this massive change where people have kind of gone, right, that was really rough, we were forced to close, but rethink about how they are operating and whether they need to be open 7 days a week, or like whether they need to be doing this and that, like cutting it right back and just making it a little bit more of a, I guess, like a sustainable business. So I think that's one positive.
Yeah, I found it quite emotional actually watching, you know, our whole industry obviously panic initially, but the speed at which people would like pivot and come up with a food bag or take home boxes or whatever, you know, like that's really not easy. And I thought it was, I found it quite emotional how people just rolled up their sleeves and held their heads up high and went, you know, we'll get through this.
Mm-hmm. And I think talking about a sustainable business means so much more than, you know, logging onto zero and looking at the profit margins. It's about investing in your staff and making sure that they're, you know, looked after mentally, financially. And I thought that was really cool how you gave everyone a week off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if anyone needs a week off, it's this year. Yeah. And especially in hospitality. So that was such an interesting idea. It was paid.
It was a paid week leave off. As well. Yeah. No one had to use any leave or anything. We just paid for everyone to have a week off, and we need it, because even though, you know, everyone's like, oh yeah, but there was lockdown, everyone got a chance to rest, it was like there was no rest during lockdown.
No,
it was different.
It was there was like the stress of like what are we coming back to, and like planning for different scenarios and like, so once we got back into it and, you know, we'd been just running like hamsters on a wheel for months, you know, keeping everything running along, I think we were all like, all right, now we actually need a real break,
because
we're tired and we're about to go into Christmas. So we were like, let's just all go and do
it's a good shout. I mean, I think it cannot be underestimated how disruptive the year's been for people emotionally and mentally, you know, like just because you're physically carrying on. Like I did a check-in survey with our Fatima's team at the end of the first lockdown, and it was kind of like a how are you all good,
yeah,
can we help with anything, blah blah blah, and they were really honest in their responses, and the team weren't coping as well as I presumed they were, and I think it's just all the anxieties of, you know,
we have a lot of international team members, you know, and some of them...
So they're isolated.
Yeah, were, you know, they can't see their families. Yeah. Some of them were actually due to go and leave to see their families, and then suddenly that was cancelled. Like, we had a lot of things booked in, like, for events we were doing, Melbourne, Hong Kong, the US, all cancelled, you know, and then, like... It was just kind of like your whole world changed so quickly. Yeah,
and suspense.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we're so grateful for you making time for us because you're literally one of the busiest people on the planet.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Got very, very bad at saying no to things, so I'm grateful for you coming in. Please go and get the book. If you don't win it, go and buy it. It's really beautiful. Photos by Amber Jane Bain, and I can't pronounce the...
Manya Washsmith.
It's absolutely stunning. Hardback. It's $65 from all good bookstores, but especially Unity, our friends at Unity Books.
Very beautiful
book. Published by Penguin Random House, who have been kind enough to gift us this one to give to you. And thanks again for joining us, Monique. We haven't even had time to drink the Kawa Kawa tea that we foraged.
Oh, I love Kawa Kawa tea.
Yeah, thanks, Monique.
Well, I'm really excited to eat Patricia's menu because she's one of my favorite authors, and that sounds so cool.
Such a legend.
Her daughter Miriyama has been doing lots of illustrations for us at the moment.
That's cool.
Nice. Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you, really nice to meet you.
Ka kite, everyone.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Hello for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-Off Podcast Network.